People in Iran, Iraq, and other countries mark the anniversary of the U.S. assassination of top Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror commanders. U.S. Democrats and a group of Republicans blast as undemocratic an attempt by nearly a dozen senators to challenge Joe Biden's presidential victory in Congress. The United States has reported a record of more than 277,000 daily COVID-19 infections, raising the total confirmed cases to 20.4 million. Good to have you with us. Now, people in Iraq have marked the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's top General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas. People in the Iraqi capital Baghdad held a candle vigil near the city's airport. The ceremony took place at the site of a drone attack that took the lives of General Soleimani al-Mohandas last January. Earlier on Saturday, Iraqi people also hit the streets of Baghdad to mourn the deaths of the two commanders. They chanted slogans demanding revenge for their killings. Iraqi demonstrators also renewed calls for the expulsion of American forces from their country. Anti-American sentiments have been growing in Iraq since the U.S. killing of Soleimani and al-Mohandas. From the Yemeni city of Sada, in the same story as I was just telling you about, the Iraqis commemorating the assassination of General Soleimani and the Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas. Different events have been taking place in different parts of the world. It was not only in Iraq and Iran we had yesterday and the day before.
اللواء الركن أمين حميد الحميري ونحن من هذا المكان
People in Yemen out there in the streets, large crowds of people from the Yemeni city of Sada, special ceremony attended by masses of people. They are commemorating the first anniversary of the assassination of Iran's anti-terror icon, Lieutenant General Soleimani. Well, as far as I understand, the speaker in Arabic is reciting sentences, and people are repeating after him, and they're pledging allegiance with the path of resistance spreading out in the region in Iraq and Lebanon, in Syria, also in Yemen. And they are commemorating the icons of resistance in the region. That is General Soleimani of Iran and also Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas, the commander of the PMU forces, the deputy commander in Iraq. And this is the resistance, the front in Yemen against the Saudi aggression, that the people there are now, apart from paying homage to General Soleimani and Abu Mahdis, they're also renewing their allegiance with the path of resistance in the region, including in Yemen. This is putting up stiff resistance against the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. Now, Tehran University Professor Elham Kadkhodai says that the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani has strengthened his legacy in Iran and elsewhere in the region.
The killing of General Soleimani was an act of terror. So that's that. The second fact is that, you know, Iran has been experiencing these types of terrorism from the very beginning of the Islamic Revolution. You know, some very, very important, significant figures in Iran, like Ayatollah Beheshti, were assassinated with the hope of stopping this kind of march that the Iranian people had started towards their own independence. So the whole thing, you know, you have a system in Iran. Iran has got a sophisticated military, political system. That's not going to be stopped if you act like this, killing individuals. Of course, General Soleimani was a very significant figure. He had a lot of influence in the way that the Quds Force was acting, but certainly nothing is going to be stopped without him. Everything is just going to go on as, the way it was going before, even maybe stronger, because this act of terrorism has angered the Iranian people. The funeral itself was something that attracted a lot of attention. I mean, it was something that the whole machinery of Western propaganda could not deny. So people were seeing Iranians flocking to the streets to say their last goodbyes, their last farewell to the beloved general. But I still believe that the true personality, the true character of General Soleimani is not somehow known in the West.
Iranian academics have marked the first anniversary of the assassination of top commander Soleimani. They also call for studies to be made on the personality of the general who served as a role model for the youth. Salman Kujuri has a report on that.
Tehran University has held a ceremony to mark the anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's Minister of Science and Technology, who was attending the ceremony, said that universities and academic centers have great capacities to keep the path of Qasem Soleimani alive by studying different aspects of his personality and beliefs.
General Qasem Soleimani was a great person. His personality had different aspects. I believe that academic centers should study his behaviors and personality. I think his lifestyle and beliefs serve as a good role model for all the youth of our country and the world. We have great capacities and potentials at universities and academic centers in this regard.
The event in Tehran came as people and officials attended a ceremony in the city of Kerman, the burial place of General Qasem Soleimani, to remember his lofty status 1 year after his martyrdom.
The martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani had a big impact on the minds of people, both because of his own personality and what happened after his martyrdom. Therefore, for a researcher and an expert of social sciences, his martyrdom provides a wide range of topics to study.
General Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, and his trench mate Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were assassinated along with their companions in a U.S. terror drone strike near Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. Meanwhile, in response, the IRGC targeted the U.S. airbase of Ain al-Assad in Anbar province in western Iraq to retaliate the U.S. assassination of top Iranian anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Moreover, according to Iranian officials, Tehran has filed a lawsuit against the U.S. for assassinating General Soleimani, and soon a court session will be held in Iran in this regard. Iranian officials believe that more than anything, the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani has proved to the global public opinion that the U.S. administration is the leading sponsor of terrorism in the world. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Also in Syria, people have come together in the capital, Damascus's countryside, to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Soleimani, who was assassinated by the U.S. in Iraq. Press TV's correspondent Mohammed Ali has more in his report.
Crowds of people as well as officials have flocked to Sayyida Zainab Shrine near Damascus to pay tribute to Iranian top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. In an address to the ceremony, Iran's ambassador to Syria said General Soleimani was a symbol assassinated by the U.S. to force Iranians to kneel, stressing that the resistance front will triumph and take revenge of Soleimani's blood.
The Iranian nation will never sit back against those who carried out the crime. Those behind the crime will be punished. Iran will continue supporting Syria and its army until the Syrian army's sovereignty is restored on all territories.
Other speakers underlined the effective role of martyr Soleimani in defeating Daesh terrorists in Syria and Iraq and foiling Western plots across the region. Representative of the Syrian army in the ceremony praised General Soleimani as a brave and wise commander who won the trust of all resistance fighters.
We have gathered here today tribute to martyr Soleimani. His sacrifices will not be forgotten. We will continue adhering to resistance as a sole option. We promise martyr Soleimani that his memory will be our path.
The crime of assassinating General Soleimani amounts to international terrorism in its ugliest form. General Soleimani's assassination is a great loss to Iran, Syria, and the resistance front. But thousands of Soleimanis are yet to come.
Photos of General Soleimani were also showcased in and around Sayyida Zainab Shrine. General Soleimani, who was assassinated by the U.S. in January 2020 in Iraq, led Iranian military advisors in Syria for years across Syrian territories, mainly Aleppo, Damascus, and Deir ez-Zor. His command played a major role in restoring stability to hundreds of square kilometers in Syria. General Soleimani's significant achievements in Syria cannot be forgotten by the people here. Syrians have marked his first martyrdom anniversary by showing appreciation to his support and acknowledgement that security in so many areas in Syria wouldn't have been possible without his presence. Hamad Ali from Sayyida Zainab Shrine, Damascus Countryside.
The 3rd of January marks the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's General Soleimani. While people are mourning his death, many are reflecting on his significance, such as how he eradicated terrorism and supported the Palestinian cause. Many have also seen the true nature of the U.S. after it assassinated a man who was key in defeating the Daesh terrorist group.
On the morning of January the 3rd, 2020, the world woke up to the news that top Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani had been martyred in Baghdad by a US drone strike, killing General Soleimani and his entourage. The assassination came as Lieutenant General Soleimani had arrived in Iraq at the invitation of the Iraqi government as part of his ongoing mission to fight terrorism in the region, terrorism that saw the Daesh group firmly in the sights of the Iranian military hero. The killing of General Soleimani was unlawful, as UN rapporteur Agnes Callamard clearly pointed out in her report following the assassination, suggesting a legal case against the perpetrators was the way forward. With the ultimate decision to perform the strike on the convoy of General Soleimani lying solely at the feet of the US president, it seems that Iran has a clear case against Trump for the charge of a war crime, as there was no justification for the killing, as confirmed in the UN report. However, the fact that the assassination took place and very little has been done on an international scale to condemn the murder, it appears to have given a green light to other nations to take illegal actions against Iran, in particular the recent example of the killing of Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, with officials stating that there had been strong indications that the Israeli regime had been involved in the attack.
Yes, certainly there has to be accountability for this violent and illegal assassination of General Soleimani. The United States, of course, has always felt it is above the law. It doesn't have to maintain any kind of respect for international law or human rights. And that is one of the reasons that the Donald Trump administration proceeded with this assassination. However, this sends the wrong message to the world community. If the United States can get away with it, then anyone can get away with it. So this must be pursued in the international courts. It's interesting to see that Iran is doing just that.
Yet as the anniversary approaches and ultimately passes, Iran has clearly stated that it will pursue its legal duty to fight for justice for the assassination of General Soleimani, and the memory of the talented and much respected general will live on forever in the hearts of those seeking to continue his mission of making the region a safer place to live.
Now, the targeted killing of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani is deemed illegal based on international law. Iran has opened a war crime case against the U.S. and President Donald Trump. Tehran says it will pursue the case at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Now, the U.S. has said that it killed General Soleimani because he had posed an imminent threat, but Washington has failed to provide evidence for the claim. Now, President Trump himself has stated that he ordered Soleimani's assassination. Therefore, he should be prosecuted for the illegal act. Now, it's a matter of time that Trump would be prosecuted or not, but if there is no accountability, other nations could view the inaction as a green light to assassinate key officials of other countries.
The humiliating defeat for Donald Trump that saw Joe Biden sweep to a landslide victory is a sign of just how poor the decisions made have been perceived by the people of the U.S.
Yet as the commander-in-chief of the US military, his decision to call the strike on General Soleimani was a decision that severely dented his international reputation. But as his last few days in office approach, US boats in the Persian Gulf have started maneuvers in the region, suggesting that Trump is looking for one last act of power prior to his departure, believing that until now, he's gotten away with his heinous acts. But for Iran, the most wicked act of all has yet to be dealt with. The assassination of General Soleimani has yet to see Iran take revenge for the murder, and is something that Iran has stated cannot be rushed and will happen in a matter of time.
I think we can say that currently Iran is taking action against the United States by pursuing this assassination in the courts. Someone must be held responsible and accountable for the assassination. Iran is going through the proper channels to do so. That is certainly one method that Iran can take to rectify this situation. The United States, on the other hand, if it's going to invade Iran, it's going to happen in the next 19 days, which is the last of Donald Trump's administration. While I don't expect things will improve greatly under a Biden administration, they will certainly improve somewhat, probably to the reinstatement of the JCPOA.
But for Lieutenant General Soleimani, the hero of people from across the region and the rest of the world, his ongoing work is being continued by devoted followers and freedom fighters from Iraq to Syria and Palestine to Yemen, and this continuation will be one of the best forms of revenge. Furthermore, with General Soleimani being a champion of fighting terrorism in the region, as well as resisting the US presence in the area, it seems that the sweetest revenge of all has been the victory over the US-backed Daesh group and the American assets in the region leaving the area, providing a safe, free and healthy living environment for the people of the region.
Now, in other news, a group of U.S. Republican senators has pledged to reject Joe Biden's victory during a congressional meeting to certify the results of the presidential election. Senator Ted Cruz is spearheading the challenge, joined by his 10 other colleagues. Cruz says that they want Congress to investigate claims of vote rigging during the November 3rd election in 10 days. The largely symbolic move is unlikely to succeed, as most senators are expected to confirm Biden as president on the 6th of January. That's when Congress counts the Electoral College votes. Democrats and moderate Republicans have blasted the effort as undemocratic. The Biden campaign has also dismissed it as theater. President Donald Trump has refused to concede defeat and repeats unproven claims of election fraud. The United States has reported a record of more than 277,000 daily COVID-19 infections, raising the total confirmed cases to 20.4 million. With just under 350,000 deaths, more people have died of the virus in the U.S. than anywhere in the world. Experts are warning that another 115,000 could die over the next month. Hospitalizations are also at their highest level, with a record number of patients being admitted into hospitals for the fourth straight day. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says it's administered more than 4 million first doses of COVID-19 vaccines in the country out of over 13 million distributed doses. The figure falls well behind President Trump's promise of 20 million jabs by the end of 2020. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. In the first part, we saw how in 1951, inhabitants of a French village were suddenly tormented by terrifying hallucinations. At least seven people died, dozens were taken to a local asylum, and hundreds were affected. Immediately, wild theories started emerging to explain this mysterious case of mass insanity. There were claims of poisoned flour, contaminated water, and even witchcraft. The truth was stranger than any of these theories. The Central Intelligence Agency had spiked the local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment at the height of the Cold War. And with time, U.S. government's interest in LSD shifted from a defensive to an offensive orientation. While the initial experiments with LSD were fairly simple, if shockingly unethical, over time, these LSD experiments grew increasingly elaborate. Stay with us as victims reveal the naked truth in the next part of this program.
Entire populations bore the consequence of large-scale tests. Here are some examples, again, uncontested cases that are recognized by the American government. In 1953, radioactive iodine was injected into newborns and pregnant women at Iowa University and also in Nebraska. In 1955, the CIA sprayed whooping cough bacteria off the coast of Tampa. Two died and dozens fell ill. Also in 1955, the CIA enlisted prostitutes in San Francisco, opened two brothels and tested drugs on the clients, then filmed through a one-way mirror. In 1956, the Army released millions of mosquitoes carrying yellow fever and dengue on the towns of Savannah and Avon. There were several deaths and hundreds of people infected. In 1960, in Cincinnati, the Army financed a radiation program on 90 destitute or ill inhabitants of the city's university hospital. Some died after several weeks. In 1966, the Army tested a virus in the New York Metro, then in Chicago. The bacteria was concealed in electric bulbs. The aim was to study the spread of chemical agents on a large scale. For these experiments, the Army or the CIA funded laboratories in the most prestigious universities, Yale, Stanford, Harvard, or Columbia. They all took part, glorified by the idea of working for the nation's defense. The researchers went crazy.
Dr. Kligman in Philadelphia increases a dosage 468 times, which actually frightened Dow Chemical. They couldn't believe that a respected doctor would do that. In Washington, D.C., you had Walter Freeman, who was a very, very well-known lobotomist who traveled around the country doing lobotomies in his car. And he would use an ice pick. He could do 15 to 20 in a day. It was just incredible what some doctors did, and very few, if any, people in the hospital or the medical community blew the whistle on it. It really was an egregious act, and it showed that the medical community was more interested in protecting its ass than in protecting the test subject and the patients, because a lot of doctors went off the deep end and started doing things that are just inconceivable now.
To express his indignation, Alan Hornblum wrote half a dozen books, a former prison guard at Holmesburg in Pennsylvania. From his first day at work over 40 years ago, he had a horrible shock.
I was stunned to see scores of inmates with their shirts off, strapped and wrapped in bandages and gauze tape. And I couldn't imagine that I was going into an atmosphere that was that violent, because all of the men looked like they had just walked a cell block knife fight.
They explain that it's not because of any violence, but experiments that are carried out there. Alan was the first to denounce this scandal and would lose his job as a result.
It was probably the largest human experimentation factory in America, possibly the world. From 51 until 1974, more people were probably incorporated in more experiments than any other place in the world.
In disease, viruses, cancerous cells, plutonium, sarin gas. The most toxic products were tested in Holmesburg, but also in dozens of prisons throughout the country. To condemn these experiments, Alan Hornblum found former inmates like Youssef. In 1961, this man was imprisoned for selling marijuana. He was poor, with limited education. He was offered a chance to take part in tests for $1 a day. Since then, Youssef has had his digestive tract operated on. He has liver and skin problems and can no longer work. His first test was for a bath foam from the company Johnson & Johnson.
They took tape and they stuck it on your back and pulled it off, stuck it on and pulled it off until the first layer of skin came off your back. And they put six sections on my back like that. And then they took a bottle with the Johnson & Johnson bubble bath and put it on a patch and put the patch over the raw area. Then they took a can. I recognized that can as being from the Army. And I was like, what Johnson & Johnson got to do with this? So he took the can and he sprayed it on my back. And when it hit my back, it was cold. But it was so toxic and like fumes, I could taste it in my mouth. And as I'm walking down, I'm getting dizzier and dizzier, dizzier and dizzier. By the time I stepped into my cell, I passed out. Boom, and my back was inflamed. And by the time I woke up that morning, I had great big blisters on my back full of pus. This rash just gets worse and worse. And it looks like when the moon come out at night, it flames up and I'll be moaning and crying and moaning and crying. My cell partners couldn't sleep. We goes over there, a little shot cup, and it looked like water. We drinks it. Everything became magnified, and the sound, like the loudspeaker on the system. Ooh, ooh, ooh. The walls look like they turned into water. You know what I mean? And like I spent the whole time like looking around like this here instead of doing the test. So I go back to the block in that condition. And man, I mean, I was tripping. And it was like a slow acting drug that was in that cup. It lasts for weeks. The inmates start naming me Outer Limits. I had no conversation for nobody. I was scared of the inmates, and the inmates act like they was afraid of me.
What you had were hundreds and hundreds of uneducated minorities, overwhelmingly black and Puerto Rican, and then you had white doctors with white lab coats with PhD or MD after their name. And it was a recipe for abuse, if not disaster. And those prison walls are an ideal spot to do controversial experiments because just as those walls keep the inmates in, they also keep the public out, so no one finds out about it.
Prisoners were used, but also patients. In certain hospitals, patients were steered towards the services financed by the CIA. These services carried out limitless experiments on psychological manipulation. In 1965, Karen Wetmore was only 13 when she was admitted to a hospital in Vermont. She stayed there several times in her childhood. She suffered from severe depression after falling victim to a pedophile neighbor. Admitted against her will, she was not allowed any contact with her family, being told that it was for her own good.
The CIA was specifically looking for children between the ages of 13 and 18 to further dissociate. They wanted dissociative children. There's a sense of absolute and total helplessness. You're there, you're bound up, you're locked in this room, no matter how you scream. No matter what you say, no one is going to come. It does something to you, something you don't get over.
The doctors went to work on Karen. They wanted to erase her memory and create a robot at their command. It took 30 years of legal battles for Karen to obtain her medical records and discover the violence of the treatments she was subjected to.
It says seclusion, full cam. A cam is a straitjacket. And ties, which means they tied my arms and they tied my feet. This goes on uninterrupted, day after day, week after week, February, March, April, right up until June 21st, 1971. You sleep on the floor. On the floor, no blanket, no nothing. And my arms were secured like this, behind my back. I do remember that. It's extremely painful because it pulls on your neck, pulls on your shoulder. You can't get away from it. It's maddening is what it is, maddening. And I was naked. And I think that was part of the effort of that experiment to break me down. Everything they did was to break me down.
Months in a confined room with no bearings, while her captors administered all kinds of drugs and sometimes electric shocks at inhuman levels.
Number of shocks and the seconds that they held the shocks, they had 30, 30, 35, 35, 35, and they held it for sustained for 40 seconds. A normal shock would be a second. Certainly not 30 and 35 of them. One, not that many, which probably is what obliterated my memory right there. And I think that's the way they did it. That's the way they did it. They also said, in this treatment right here, no seizure, shock restarted, so they gave me a second one. Because they couldn't produce a seizure. So they must have done it over again. Must have repeated it. It's unforgivable. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one they did this to. I'm sure. I survived to be able to talk about it.
How many suffered similar experiments? In Montreal, Canada, the CIA used a world-renowned psychiatrist to set up a factory of guinea pigs in the Allen Memorial Psychiatric Department in McGill University. This psychiatrist was Ewan Cameron, one of the all-powerful presidents of the World Psychiatric Association. In 1945, Ewan Cameron made the acquaintance of Rudolf Hess, one of the Nazis accused in the Nuremberg trial. In 1957, the CIA recruited him for their MK-Ultra program. The Americans wanted to perfect their interrogation techniques and program a human to kill. Ewan Cameron became the mad dog of psychiatry. He put his patients in vegetative states for several weeks while bombarding them with pre-recorded orders. Some would become incontinent, amnesiac, forgetting even who their parents were and how to speak. The Vermont hospital where Karen Wetmore was confined was working on the same program. In the hands of the CIA doctors, she was like a rag doll.
They used drugs like LSD. They used electric shock. They used chemical shock agent metrazole, which I was given in 1971. And I found that out in my medical records, which is a very brutal drug, very brutal drug. CIA said it was excruciating physically and emotionally, excruciating drug. I have a quote from the CIA that said that the Soviets used it in the gulags and that a POW would say or do anything to avoid a second dose. Nice drug.
There's all kinds of people who believe and people who don't believe, and that's a debate about do you believe or don't believe. I'm always interested in what are in the documents saying. So the documents clearly describe implanting electrodes in people's brains, activating the electrode from a remote transmitter, and changing the person's behavior from angry, pounding the wall, sitting there just staring.
Behind Karen's ear is a scar. And she doesn't know what it's from.
Once my therapist really understood that I had really been experimented on, by the CIA, she said to me, you know, just for the heck of it, let me look. Because we'd heard about, we'd read about, there's been information about these implants. And I'm like, okay. And it was there, actually there. I showed you. I went to a plastic surgeon who told me it was a surgical scar. But there's nothing in my medical history, nothing in a medical record that shows any kind of problem ever behind my right ear, or any incision or any surgery or anything else. But there it is.
What stopped the journey down this destructive path? In 1973, while Watergate is rattling all the institutions, Richard Helms, director of the CIA, feels the winds of change. He works as a lone wolf and hasn't informed the president of these experiments. He knows he's crossed the line. To protect himself, he orders the destruction of all documents relating to the MKUltra program and its abandonment. 2 years later, in 1975, the President Gerald Ford orders an inquiry into the CIA. The Rockefeller Commission is sworn in. The task isn't simple, because at the heart of the CIA, even Richard Helms' close lieutenants know nothing about the brainwashing programs.
There's a lot of goofy things go on in a big agency like that with all that secrecy. Things can go on that you don't know about, that the people who are working for the director most closely don't know about, or that the director doesn't know about. I mean, they're keeping it quiet down there. You don't tell anybody. If it works, then we'll tell them. But, you know, in the meantime, don't get into any difficulties. I remember when they wanted to take a kitty cat and stick a microphone up its rear end and put an antenna on its ear and have him walk in if he's a spy in the park with another one, walk over and walk around and listen in on it. You know, they tried it one time in an experiment, and a taxi came by and ran over the cat. You know, so.
In reality, nothing is funny. In its haste to get rid of evidence, the CIA forgets 20,000 documents. A drop of water compared to the amount that was destroyed, but they reveal that it financed 149 programs, implicating 80 institutions, including the most respected. Called on to justify themselves, the heads of the CIA, like Dr. Lashbrook, lie and downplay the facts.
There was, of course, claims or thoughts that maybe great things could be done with hypnosis. One small project in which we had a hypnotist do some experiments, primarily to see what the limitations of hypnosis might be. Can you make a person do something under hypnosis that he would not ordinarily do?
Even if the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, tried to minimize the scale of the experiments, the victims' testimonies contradict him.
The next thing I remember,
the inquiry commissions follow, each reaching more and more witnesses, like this woman, Chris DeNicola. Her father put her in the hands of a reputed CIA doctor, Dr. Green, when she was 12 years old.
His objective was to gain control of my mind and train me to be a spy assassin. Dr. Green had electrodes on my body, including my head. He used what looked like an overhead projector and repeatedly said he was burning different images into my brain while a red light flashed aimed at my forehead. In between each sequence, he used electric shock on my body and told me to go deeper and deeper, deeper, while repeating each image would go deeper into my brain and I would do whatever he told me to do. Dr. Green moved on to wanting me to kill dolls that look like real children.
Inquiry reports that resulted from these terrifying testimonies revealed one thing for certain. The experiments ended in disaster. In its insane quest for a robot human or a truth serum, the CIA failed. On August 3rd, 1995, with the revelations mounting up, then-President Bill Clinton makes a public apology. Since then, a great number of secret archives have been released to the public domain. Researchers would take an interest in this troubled period, notably Hank Albarelli, who worked on the suspicious death of Frank Olson, the biochemist who worked at the heart of the CIA. Since 1951, the year of the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident, Frank Olson called into question the ethics of the experiments being carried out and became depressed as a result. In November 1953, the CIA put LSD into his glass without him knowing. 9 days later, he threw himself off the 13th floor of a New York hotel. Murder or suicide, we'll never know. At the time of the investigation, Hank Albarelli found a surprising document coming from the White House. It surprisingly linked the name of Frank Olson to Pont Saint-Esprit. Why, in the middle of the Korean War, would the White House be interested in this small French village? Even better, Hank also came across a study carried out by the CIA on LSD.
The document itself was a comprehensive overview or history, if you will, of LSD specifically, yes. Not on ergot, had nothing to do with ergot. There was a section or chapter, if you will, headed incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. And the first two paragraphs of that describe essentially what we've all read, you know, many times over in terms of what happened at Pont Saint-Esprit. But the remainder of that section, the rest of that page, which was about half the page, and the two pages that followed, were completely blocked out.
Above all was this damning document from the CIA. It dates from 1953 and has no doubt been declassified by mistake. A director at Sandoz Laboratories confirmed to a secret agent that the Pont Saint-Esprit incident was caused by LSD. Sandoz Laboratories was where Albert Hoffman worked, the man who discovered LSD. It even claimed the drug was responsible for the Pont Saint-Esprit tragedy, before recanting. This same document states that in 1952, the source at the CIA had already explained that the cursed bread was caused by LSD. Did French authorities try to silence the affair? Several years after the drama, a head of the Victims Association was shocked at how disinterested the investigators were. Do the French have something to hide? We've interrogated former members of the Secret Services, investigated national and regional archives, as well as those from the police and the Justice Department. The files are hard to find, and many important pieces, such as reports from main hearings, have disappeared. If America revealed unwillingly some of its secrets about its participation in the poisoning, the uncertainties over the involvement of the French authorities may yet go on for some years longer. It takes 75 years for some sensitive documents to be made public. Hidden in its small streets and stone buildings, Le Pont Saint-Esprit drama has yet to reveal all its secrets.
Judging from the CIA's dark and notorious past of misconduct, perhaps it'll be no surprise if horrific clandestine high-tech experiments are being carried out somewhere in the world by the CIA at this very moment. Secrets that we must wait 75 years to be declassified, if ever disclosed to the public at all. And that's everyone for this week on Aperture. It's goodbye.
Stories from the past.
stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Brothers and sisters, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. As always, it's a pleasure and honor to have a share of a few moments of your day as we reflect upon the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam in the form of everyday stories regarding great personalities and figures, anecdotes, analogies. Because at the end of the day, we do what we can in order to find a glimpse of the light of truth in our lives. The story we're going to be discussing today is very similar to that of Nabi Ayyub alayhi salam, which we've talked about on our show, I think, on several occasions. So let's listen to the story real quick, and we'll see how this story is similar to that of the Prophet of God.
In the name of Allah, dear friends, so welcome to this program, Lantern. Today's story is entitled Feeling Pleased with Whatever Pleases Allah. One of the students of Sheikh Behjat, the great scholar, says, "One day I went to the house of Sheikh Behjat a few minutes before the start of the class, because often the Sheikh used to attend the classroom. And he would narrate a story or a tradition or a moral lesson till all the students attend. Luckily, as I entered, he came to the room early and said this to me after the greeting and the salutation. In the city of Najaf, a handsome Iranian youth was with us from the people of Hamadan. And he was famous for being neat and physically well-formed. One day, this youth became paralyzed to the extent he could not walk except after leaning on a cane. I tried not to meet him due to his particular condition. Therefore, I used to avoid meeting him so I would not add one more grief to his griefs. One day, I got out of the alley and saw him standing in the street, so I had no choice except to meet him. Without contemplating, I asked him, 'How do you feel?' But I was upset with having said so and kept saying this to myself, 'What empty talk is this? Do you not see in what condition he is?' But contrary to my expectation, when he opened his mouth to answer my question, his speech was like cool water with which he put out what I had felt inside. He kept praising and thanking Allah with a spirit filled with activity and pleasure, as if he was drowned in blessings of Allah, the praised and the most exalted one. I felt relieved and my grief departed from me."
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
In the story of this man that we heard about, he was known for his appealing appearance, but he was crippled and he was paralyzed. The same was the story of Nabi Ayyub alayhi salam, if you guys remember. He was known for being like above blessed, especially blessed, whether it was about having many good children, whether it was regarding his wealth, his harvest, his crops, his livestock, you know, him being loved by his community and the tribe that he lived in. And shoop, Allah takes all of that away from him. And Nabi Ayyub alayhi salam is still grateful. The point of that, however, isn't that Allah is going to give you a blessing and then take it away from you. Because obviously, Allah is not a child with an ant farm. He's not a bully, na'udhu billah. He wants us to, number one, be happy. He genuinely wants us to be happy, because unless we are happy, we won't be able to engage in other productive activities in our life, whether it's acts of worship, whether it's contributing to the society we're living in, whether it's academic activities and growth. Unless we're happy, and by happiness, I don't mean that euphoric buzz of adrenaline in our body, the same feeling I get after watching a nice movie or having really good chocolate with chai. By happiness, I mean that state of being and mind where I'm elevated, that state of being and mind where I feel a constant flow of energy within myself. I'm motivated, I'm driven, I have an inner encouragement and strive to do better, to be better, to do good things. That's the kind of happiness Allah wants for us. And depending on our capacity and the situation that we're in, He lets us experiment with different occasions and events in order to find that level of happiness within us. So when it comes to trials and tests, Allah puts us again in scenarios that elevate that sense of drive within us. And also, like we said, Allah wants us to grow. So, and that's the main objective. It is upon us to be able to find that state of happiness and inner contentment and strive in every situation that Allah puts us in. The other thing about putting us through tests that we hate, like the Quran says, "Asa an takrahu shay'an wa huwa khayrun lakum." Often do you hate something, but it's actually good for you. I'm not going to bring in the whole bitter medicine analogy thing. But I am going to say that He puts us through those tests so we can realize one thing. There's a hadith from one of the infallibles, alayhim salawatullah wassalam, that says one of the levels of giving thanks to Allah is to realize that a blessing is from God directly without considering any of the mediums. Sometimes we get so involved in these mediums, in these middle factors, these middlemen, when we receive a blessing, that we forget entirely that it was Allah who is responsible for this bounty that has been bestowed upon us. Like when it comes to beauty, we are so quick to say, well, good genes. You know, my mom was pretty and my dad was handsome and, you know, they got married and the result is a beautiful child. Well, I could have seriously picked up the worst genes. I mean, no one's perfect. I could have picked up the worst genes in both parents. But Allah decided to bless me or her or him or whoever with the best of each world. That within itself is a test. And I have to recognize that. I'm not saying that I have to be in a constant state of anxiety that, oh my God, this blessing has been given to me. When is it going to be taken away? But I must be in a constant state of awareness. I must be on the edge of my seat in the sense that I do not neglect this blessing that Allah has given to me. I do not neglect the source of this blessing. I do not misuse this blessing. I must constantly be cautious, aware, and careful that I don't waste this blessing. And wasting this blessing could mean a lot of things. It could mean not giving enough gratitude for it, not expressing enough gratitude for it, or using it in a way that it was not meant to be used, or not using it at all. That's all the time that we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.